Hey, what's good, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the High Existence Podcast. This is Eric Brown, and today we're back with potentially one of my favorite episodes to date. We're dropping in with Jake Coburn, one of the most powerful and damn interesting humans I've come across recently. Jake is a visionary artist, DJ, podcaster, teacher, speaker, and magician in the truest sense of the term. Jake has a formal art background. He studied in Florence, Italy, and he's taken that skill set into the world of visionary art, attempting to bring the visions and experiences he's had in his own life into the public domain through his art. He's also extremely studied and practiced in the world of ritual and ceremonial magic, and just deeply knowledgeable about the occult and esoteric traditions at large. You'll see this in some of the conversation. He's also in the process of releasing a Magic 101 course. And of course, as always, you can always find links to the course, his podcast, his artworks, and all the resources mentioned here down in the show notes. This is a really unbelievable conversation. We talk about how language shapes reality, a deep dive into practical and ceremonial magic, take a look at the state of spirituality, and just a lot more. Jake has an uncanny ability to mix humility with really sharp wit and just deep knowledge. And if you're ready to dive into all things weird and wonderful, you will absolutely love this conversation. Enjoy. All right, welcome back, everybody. We got a big one today. I've been following Jake and his work for probably 3 or 4 years now, and man, it represents a space and a place and a person that I think is long overdue for you guys, our audience, and in this world. Jake, really nice to meet you. Really thankful that you're here.
It's great to meet you too, man. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, so I was saying earlier before we started recording, man, you have your hands in many places. There's a lot to keep up with you on your side of things. So I wanted to float the first question of just, how do you answer the question of who are you and what you do?
Yeah, it is an interesting question. I think that what I'm doing is a lot about working with the self. You know, even astrologically, it's like I'm Aries dominant person. And basically, that's the major question for Aries is like, who am I? And that's sort of a question that seems always kind of looming and lingering for me, and something that I tend to redefine really frequently, kind of discard old identities or definitions of self, and I'm always exploring new avenues, or I get sort of like tired with a certain conception of myself and then have to change it. But you know, like I've identified as being an artist for most of my life, and I've allowed myself the liberty of that title since I was a teenager, and I still identify as an artist. Even though, I mean, I even go through periods of time where that's not necessarily my focus, but it still rings true to me to consider myself an artist.
Yeah, if you're going to use any catch-all term, that's probably one of the closer ones. Awesome. Yeah, and so I'm going under the assumption here that, and I hope that it's a wrong assumption, but I'm going to go under the assumption that we're actually introducing you to a lot of the audience here. And I mentioned earlier that I may have taken a kind of backwards route to you and your work because I first discovered you through some of your SoundCloud mixes. I was and still am really big in the kind of deep, dark, and dangerous scene, the deep dubstep scene. And
right on.
You have some really fantastic mixes around that. And then through that, came to discover just your website and your presence and the rest of the work there. It seems, I would imagine that many find you through perhaps one of two avenues, either your visionary artwork or some of your presence around magic. I mean, I'd kind of like to start with the visionary art stuff just because, man, A, it's fantastic, and B, it's a deep area of interest. I mean, why don't we just start with what is visionary art? How did you get into it? How did it develop, and kind of what's your relationship to it now?
I would define visionary art as art that is inspired by mystical or visionary experiences. So for me, I've always been fascinated with the more subtle aspects of reality, which I've explored through psychedelics, but also through lucid dreaming, through ritual experiences, through astral travel, through, meditation, and just through working consciously with symbols and things like the tarot and stuff like that. And I've had a lot of these experiences that are more, I guess you could say, spiritual in nature. And those spiritual experiences have really inspired my work. And so for me, my artwork is a form of communication. It's a way of just sort of transmitting realms and dimensions of experience that I've had the opportunity to visit, with the hope that it might broaden the horizons of the viewer, at least slightly. I don't necessarily separate what I'm doing with my visual artwork with what I might be doing with work around magic or the more esoteric leanings that I have. Because if I'm, say, communicating just in terms of, theory or something like that, like esoteric theory, the visual artwork is actually a way of communication that is perhaps even superior to communicating with words, because I can more deeply communicate through the use of symbol and a visual language. So my guess is that most visionary artists have a kind of similar approach. I mean, I think that within the genre of visionary art, there's probably a lot of different reasons why people make visionary art. But for me, I was really inspired by the work of Alex Gray. And, I know his personal kind of definition of it is something similar, that it would be a firsthand eyewitness account of a visionary experience portrayed through the medium of art. I was inspired by that kind of like pioneering, trailblazing attitude, the idea that you're not just an artist, but you're also kind of like an adventurer into unknown terrains and dimensions of experience. Maybe you're going to encounter some sort of new thing, or some very ancient thing, but something very weird, at least, that's not something that most people experience, and you can capture that in your artwork.
Yeah, I've been feeling that almost pain very directly the last few months. I mean, I probably have, at this point, hundreds of thousands of words out online, speaking to people on the podcast, trying to convey some of this stuff. But man, I'm starting to feel the pain quite acutely of just the vast limitation of language to convey any of these spaces. You run up against a wall of just, yeah, what words and meaning can do to convey it. There's an almost like Zen quality, I think, in some visionary artwork, where it's just a direct transmission of the experience. It doesn't actually need words. It doesn't need a description beyond it. It's just kind of you having the experience. And yeah, I can definitely see the, maybe not influence, but overlap between you and Alex Gray. I mean, Web of Being by Alex is probably one of my favorite pieces ever. Speaks to something of like, oh yeah, that's right, that's correct, you nailed it.
Well I mean Alex Gray is a remarkable artist. I wouldn't be really the artist that I am without his influence, and I completely acknowledge that. And I think that a limitation of language is that so much of our language is based off of it needing to be rational or logical. Unless people are really on the kind of cutting edge of exploring, like somebody like William Burroughs or somebody like that was kind of exploring the, I guess you could say, like, translogical aspects of the English language and, things like, I don't know, James Joyce or someone like that. But for the most part, people are confined within a convention of language where it needs to be really clear and rational in its use. But that doesn't exist really for visual art, you know. And so a lot of our experiences when in regards to the mystical or in regards to the psychedelic are not really, you know, clear and neatly defined within rational logic. It's like paradoxical and obscure and sometimes really confusing and irrational, these experiences. And so you can portray that visually, and you can create something that appears maybe even absurd or really strange, and no one can say that it's wrong because it's art, you know? And that's like, that's really one of the beauties of just being an artist. I mean, like, artists can get away with a lot. They can say things that are totally crazy, and it's art, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's almost one of, depending on how it lands for people, probably one of the most beneficial, I'll speak personally. It's been one of the most beneficial parts of mystical and psychedelic experiences for me. It's also the classic hallmark of a mystical or psychedelic experience. It's just ineffable. And when you come back from that and you then just go back into the ingrained habit of trying to put it into language, you recognize that you're fumbling with something completely inadequate. And at that point, yeah, things like art, things like music, poetry, probably the closest you can almost get if you're playing around with language to try to describe something like that. Because yeah, the kind of mechanical academic breakdowns just really do not run their course very far in that space. It's crazy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think there's probably within the psychedelic landscape a role for the kind of more, you know, analytical nature of the mind to do its thing. And, you know, we need some good hard science and data on mystical experiences and psychedelic experiences also to try to give some, I guess, like, greater understanding for what's occurring. But yeah, I mean, for me, it's like I've always related to it as an artist. And so kind of the people that have inspired me the most that are from that world are also artists. And even somebody like Terence McKenna, who was, you know, sort of a poet in a certain kind of mm-hmm. way, like a bard of some mm-hmm. kind, you know. And he certainly had a way with his words to be able to communicate those experiences.
Yeah, I feel that. To me now, it's almost landing as a kind of game or a kind of challenge where it's like, can you act, like, how close can you get to putting this into language? Like, that's actually a fun, it's like a mastery process almost. It's like, how close can you get to this ideal of being able to really capture those experiences in language?
Mm-hmm. Well, language is psychedelic, you know? I mean, I don't know if you've ever experimented with this, but Robert Anton Wilson, who's like one of my favorite philosophers, he has this idea. It's not his idea. I think he got it from like this guy, Korbinsky, who I've never really looked into before, but I know about it through Robert Anton Wilson. He was talking about this idea of E prime, which is the use of the English language that takes out is or makes any objective statements, basically understanding that things are only kind of true within one's own perception, you know? Yep. So an example is, you know, like, that person is mean. It's like, well, that person seems mean to me. But if you start actually trying to do this and sort of forcing yourself to speak this way, it actually really changes your experience of reality. And it's a pretty remarkable thing to experiment with. Or, you know, Genesis Piorid, she was he/she. I don't know the proper pronoun to use, but preferred to consider themselves a they to honor like the plurality of their different selves, that they understanding the fluctuations of the self in such a way that they don't exist as just like one person but many in a certain sense, and always referred to themselves as we and they and us. And if you try to speak like that and you honor that as sort of true, it's really trippy. It actually changes your experience of reality by changing the way that you use your language. And so it's a very psychedelic thing, you know, and as paradigms shift and as sort of understandings of the world shift, also the use of language shifts.
Oof. Ooh, that's a good line. Yeah, and that's actually been one of the most helpful things in some of the kind of facilitation mentorship work we do here. This frame I have now of like, what if the words and the phrasing and the intonation that everyone was using when they spoke was exactly how they meant it? Like literally exactly. So if someone says they come out and they say they hate something versus like dislike, it's like, oh, I'm tracking that. Like that's an emotionally powerful word. And you can use that to kind of start navigating the worldview reality tunnel that other people have. And of course, you can flip that back on yourself and just say, yeah, wow. Why was I so scared of that? Why did I use that language? And it becomes mind manifesting, right? It literally just holds a mirror up to you of where you're at and how you feel and how you relate to the world. It's incredibly powerful.
It's one of those aspects of life that most people are totally on autopilot with and just very unconscious to. But to sort of take back your use of language as a conscious process and to decide how you want to use language and how you want to speak and not necessarily needing to be bound by convention is a really powerful act, you know. And so I have a lot of respect for like Genesis P. Oridge or for Robert Anton Wilson besides both of them just being amazing, but also for experimenting with that and being sort of dedicated to that, because that's a challenging thing to do.
Oh, it's huge. Absolutely huge. But like anything powerful, right? It can become a very a tool for good in your life and in the world. Yeah, incredible. So we have, we've done kind of one side of the double helix. The other side I really want to explore with you and also give. I don't think we've really featured anyone on the podcast yet who has, I think, explored. I'd almost be interested to hear how you categorize it. Magic, the occult, esotericism, whatever term you want to use there, in the depth, or had it become what I feel is such a central part of life for you? So at the risk of teeing this up too much, I mean, could we actually start with your own definition of the entire space, what it's for, how it works, anything you feel called to surface around it?
Well, magic is, I guess, like for me, so like the traditional definition of magic as given by Aleister Crowley is the science and art of causing change in accordance with will. So basically the word psychokinesis relates to generally what I think I might consider magic, which is the idea that you can use aspects of your mind to influence reality. But for me, it's like you can't, you know, Crowley wrote and tried to make the stance that any sort of willed action is magic. So like what we're doing right now is magic, because we are, we have an intention to create a podcast or to communicate a message. And so we, you know, summon the forces of the recording program and whatever it is to disseminate the information out to our audience. You know, that's arguably magic, but that might just be like doing a podcast, you know, like, so for me, it's there's an aspect of novel agency involved that makes something magic. And that's basically what magic is. It's probability enhancement. So if there's a particular thing that you want to have happen, to be able to use a variety of different techniques that exist in a variety of different traditions, including rituals and visualizations and the contact of otherworldly agents like archangels or in some cases even demons, although that's not the kind of magic that I practice.
Yep.
And then using these different techniques to manifest or to increase the probability of a particular outcome that you have in mind. So it's fundamentally different than mysticism, although there are similarities. And in Aleister Crowley's system of magic, those two things are sort of combined. You can use magic for mystical purposes. You know, it is my will to experience Godhead or something like that. And you can do that. But I think that mysticism is usually like relaxing into or surrendering into a kind of deeper mystery of life. Magic has a lot to do with control. You know, magic has a lot to do with, I want this to happen, and so it will, and I will make this happen. And, you know, being able to kind of use different, to like add extra juice towards the realization of that thing to occur. And I've always been fascinated with that. I've always been fascinated with the possibility of that being real. And I've been experimenting with that since I was a kid, basically. So magic has always been a part of my life, even when I was a kid, because I was, you know, even though I wasn't trained formally or anything like that, I was experimenting with my own techniques to be able to kind of make what I wanted to happen. It's a strange thing. There can be like a sort of resistance to that. You know, like people feel like that's selfish or something. But I think that a lot of people struggle because they're not getting what they really want out of life. And I think it's kind of our birthright to at least approximate our desires in our lives. Mm-hmm. And that the world would be a happier place if more people were able to kind of realize their desires more easily. And a lot of magic is also concerned with the initiation into higher levels of reality and initiation to higher levels of awareness of the reality of the self, of really understanding who you truly are and what your purpose is, what Aleister Crowley called the true will. And so as you kind of ascend to higher levels of awareness, you're probably less likely to use magic to, you know, make the girl next door fall in love with you or something like that. And your desires and the rituals that you would enact to realize those desires become kind of less egoic, you know, fundamentally. So magic is a tool that people can use for anything, basically. And what one would use magic for has a lot to do with what stage one is in the evolution of their consciousness and in the awareness of themselves. I'm interested in the initiatory path, and I'm interested in how magic can be used to be initiated into higher levels of awareness in the pursuit of the completion of the great work, as it's called in the Western esoteric tradition, which is essentially enlightenment. And I think it's very similar as a path to certain forms of yoga or tantra and these other Eastern lineages that are also concerned with, you know, utilizing altered states of consciousness, utilizing the manipulation of subtle energies and subtle dimensions of consciousness to make alterations in one's perception.
Damn. That was a masterclass in 5 minutes right there. Man, novel agency and probability enhancement. I've never heard magic framed like that, and I absolutely love it. This is one of the things I was pointing to earlier about kind of tracking how people say things and what they invite into them and what stands the test of time in their lives. Like, again, I've come to respect you and your work a lot, and when something like magic has seemingly become such a central part of your life and how you relate to reality, I start paying attention. I mean, I'd love to, at what point did you kind of consciously lean into it where it's like, I'm going to take this seriously? Why has it lasted so long in your life? Like, what does it do for you? How do you relate to it on an individual level?
Well, it resonates, you know what I mean? And I guess that there are a lot of different sorts of flavors of spirituality within the spiritual marketplace. And I've done Buddhism, and I've done yoga, and I've done a lot of different Eastern forms of spirituality. And there's something about magic in the Western mystery tradition, the Western occult tradition, that just really resonates with me on an aesthetic level and on like a vibe level, that just feels like cool and exciting and compelling. And I like that magic, as opposed to, say, yoga, is concerned with what we actually want to create in our world. Mm-hmm. Magic is fundamentally and inherently creative. And I'm an artist, and so I'm really interested in utilizing spirituality for creative means. And the perception of existence in a lot of Eastern systems, and I don't have fully the authority to be able to speak on this, but just having read a lot about Buddhism and studied it somewhat, is that existence is a problem, and the goal is to rid yourself of the cycle of existence. And I don't think that within the Western esoteric tradition they necessarily see it that way. There is the perspective that people are trapped within the illusion of existence, but that when you have a realization of the truth of the predicament of your existence and what reality really is, that gives you a sort of, yeah, agency, freedom, and creativity to then play with it. You know, like, yeah. Reality is a sandbox that we can play with. And it's just a much more enjoyable and empowering experience to live life with a sense of creative agency. And I know a lot of people personally, and I know that there are a lot of people in the world that feel really disempowered and that don't feel like there's anything that they can do, and they're not happy with their lives in the way that they are, and they feel stuck, and they feel like it's hopeless. And it's not. And magic is a discipline, and it takes a lot of hard work, and it's intellectually rigorous, which is another reason why I find it compelling, because it is very intellectual. Yep. But if the practice is undertaken, people can see results very quickly. And I've taught some simple techniques to friends and watched as their lives have really changed very fast. So that's exciting. That's inspiring. And I think there's a lot of people, if given access to these techniques and to these ideas, and to even just the belief in magic, because to me at this point, it's not really a question if it's real or not. It's definitely real, and it's a deep sort of, I don't want to say it's a science because it's not, but it's a discipline that has been explored, written deeply about, and a tradition that has been expanded on for at least a couple thousand years.
Yep.
And in that way, it's more real than Western psychology, because Western psychology is much younger and less developed in a certain way than magic is. And I think that it's really just due to the particular predilections of our culture that magic is not represented as a subject that's worthy of real inquiry, you know, as much as psychology is or anything else.
Oh, man. There are like hundreds of threads that come up after every time you speak. Okay. One of the open threads I have that I don't want to pass over is you used the initiatory process as a term. Initiations as an idea have been coming up a lot for me this year, and particularly after some of my early exposure into ceremonies and the plant medicine psychedelic space. Can you expand on what you mean by that? What do you mean by initiation? What do you mean by initiatory process? Where are you going? Who wants to show up for that? Is it easy? Is it hard? Because I think there's something really good that could come from that.
Well, within the Western esoteric tradition, initiation generally refers to a sort of death and rebirth symbolically and experientially. And so in that sense, initiation is always kind of challenging, or at least to some aspect of the self, that it's challenging. The idea is that we can be initiated into truth or initiated into higher awareness of who we truly are. And when you undertake a plant medicine ceremony, that's certainly a kind of initiation, or at least can be if done in a certain way. And a lot of the kinds of ceremony of ceremonial magic can be a similar type of thing. And I don't know if you kind of have this phenomenon occur before you're getting ready to take a strong dose of a psychedelic or undertake like a plant medicine ceremony, where your ego kind of goes onto like hyperdrive, like it anticipates its impending mortality, and like suddenly all these weird neuroses start like coming up like a day or two before you go into the ceremony. But the same thing happens for me before I'm getting ready to undertake a big working magically. And, you know, I've done psychedelics like hundreds of times. And for me, the West, like using ceremonial magic is kind of a way of sort of just allowing myself to like go into that same type of experience. It's not exactly the same, but to have like an analogous experience without necessarily needing to take a substance, and to be able to control its duration and to be able to specifically direct the contents of the experience. Yeah. So when you take a psychedelic, you're kind of like just spinning the roulette wheel of wherever you might end up. You're opening yourself up to whatever and wherever, you know, some random zip code in the local astral with whatever kind of, you know, astral entities might exist there. But with ceremonial magic, it's kind of like, you know, punching in the zip code and knowing the phone number of the specific, you know, deity you want to talk to, and having a reason why. And it relates to it kind of, you know, like the tarot, for example, or the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, or like these beautiful maps of the soul's journey of, yeah, awakening, of realization, of initiation. And a lot of the rituals are based off specific sort of processes that were mapped out within those symbolic systems.
So ceremonial magic allows you to essentially pinpoint directly where you would want to go and be very specific about what type of experience you want to have based on the knowledge of the map of the progression of the soul's journey, and to understand what types of initiation or what types of experiential understanding you wish to gain through a ritual endeavor. And so that's useful because, like I said before, making a comparison to psychedelics, psychedelics can certainly be very, very helpful and can definitely initiate people into higher understandings and higher levels of awareness, but it's a little bit more random and a little bit more chaotic in the process. And there's no kind of like guarantees where you might end up or what the result will be. The thing with the sort of initiatory path, or the path of ceremonial magic, where these other kinds of systems in which there are well-trodden maps in place, is that a lot of people have sort of traversed the same terrain. And so there's kind of a general understanding of what needs to be done in order to traverse that particular path and to understand what you might be getting into having a particular kind of experience using a particular kind of ritual, etc. So it's sort of like you have more control over your own evolution in a certain sense, although typically it's undertaken within a traditional kind of structure in which you'd have a tutor, a mentor, a teacher, a magus to kind of like guide you through that journey. And I have had a couple mentors, which have been helpful. And, you know, I don't really consider myself in any way to be fully initiated or anything. I think I've had some initiatory experiences. But when it comes to magic, I mean, I know there's just that, you know, there are like rooms that I haven't even seen the doors to yet. You know what I mean? Like it goes so much deeper than I can probably even possibly imagine. And it's one of those things that people get into and they do for like their entire lives. It's inexhaustible, which is one of the things that also makes it so exciting.
Yeah, I share that feeling a lot. The further down the path you go, all that really happens is you see how much further the path continues to extend in front of you. And yeah, there is a, not quite a challenge, but it's like it drives a lot of vital life force in me of like, okay, we're just getting started here. I thought we were like halfway done. We're just on the first few steps. And that can be a really, I mean, sometimes that can be frustrating, right? It can make you, you can tell yourself a story about that that's not always positive, but there is always a story of like, holy crap, what is still remaining to be experienced? What can I still go do? Yeah, it's really beautiful. And yeah, one of the core themes I got from your share there was you can really become a conscious ally of your own process, basically. Yeah, I agree with you that the psychedelic experience, particularly when you're starting, there can be this flavor of you're just subjected to the experience. Like it just hits you. It takes you along for the ride. And I think there is an almost maturity mastery process where it's like, no, you can actually get on board with this. You can bring your own intention. You can really start dialing these things in. And yeah, reality also pushes you along when you start showing up for it more like that.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, in shamanic cultures, like in Peruvian shamanism and, you know, with curanderos, they will train for many years to be able to navigate the psychedelic terrain with a degree of control. So it is possible to gain a mastery over those realms and to gain a level of mastery over working with plant medicines or psychedelics as a tool, and to have, I guess you could say, some kind of control over it, or to be able, it's like, you know, to find the middle ground between, it's not like resisting, but to be able to wield it, sort of like fire spinning or something like that. You know, and there's a lot of similarities actually in certain ways to the initiatory journey as it's laid out in the West within the various esoteric lineages that exist and ceremonial magic and things like that, and shamanism and the types of initiations that people undergo and the type of training that people undergo if they're becoming a curandero or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It can become more of a kind of two-way conversation than simply just a lecture, because it can certainly start, this process can certainly start as a lecture sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You spoke to as well, actually introducing a few friends to some simple tools, techniques. And I wanted to be able to surface an example here. One of the first kind of magic pieces I saw from you was a clip you released, I think from a course you had run a year or so ago, around the process of creating your own sigil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd love if you could point to sigils, the process, the purpose, anything like that, because I think it can start to ground some of this in an actual practice, in an actual example.
Yeah, I mean, sigil magic is one of the most effective and simple forms of practical magic, and definitely something I've taught to people and seen had really impactful results in people's lives just by working with it. It's sort of a different thing than kind of like the initiatory track of Western ceremonial magic, but you can use sigils for that, and I have, and it works in a certain way. But the idea of sigil magic is that you take an intention that you want, like, I want to have flawless Wi-Fi. That could be your intention, but it could be anything. It could be like, you know, yeah, literally any sort of desire that you could have, you know, and it can be something big, something small. It doesn't seem to make a difference really. And you take that desire and you create a glyph generally, although it doesn't have to be only a glyph. It can be a work of art. It can be a piece of music. It can be a lot of different things. That is a kind of like a abstraction of the different symbols that frame that desire. So like you smush together all the different letters, remove the vowels, remove the repeating letters, and smush it together to create this symbol, this glyph. And then you charge that sigil, that glyph that you've created through ritual means, and then you forget about it. And that's basically what sigil magic is. The idea was kind of proposed by the artist Austin Osman Spare, who was also a magician, a sorcerer of sorts, and was exposed to ceremonial magic and was at one point friends with Aleister Crowley, but ended up really resenting kind of like the really pretentious, pompous kind of, you know, 20th century Victorian era ceremonial magic thing that was going on at the time, and thought it was completely divorced from reality. And so he created this system, believing and being inspired by psychology, that our subconscious mind directly impacted our reality, and that in order for a desire to be realized, it had to first take root in our subconscious mind. You can't just tell yourself superficially that you want something to happen. You have to like anticipate its occurrence on a deep level within the subconscious mind. And so sigils are a way of trying to I guess, impregnate the subconscious mind with the belief of something having occurred that you want to happen. And through its anticipation, it apparently bends reality for that thing to happen. I won't claim to know exactly how it works, but I've experienced it working, and I've also shown how to do it to a lot of people who have also experienced it working. And yeah, that's basically my spiel on sigil magic.
Yeah, and I mean, for almost everything that we mentioned here, there's going to be links. There's going to be links in show notes for all this, because you do have a video, a fantastic one, actually walking people through the process of creating a sigil. And yeah, I've had some non-trivial experiences and outcomes from giving that an actual faithful attempt. I'm actually noticing that as we talk, my ability to ask better questions and more clear questions is developing. So something you've pointed to perhaps a few times is like, there are several different forms of magic. And I don't really think we've covered that landscape. You just brought up sigil as part of practical, as separate from ceremonial. Like, is there a lay of the land you can speak to a little bit? Like,
yeah, there are a lot of different kinds of magic, and there's a lot of different traditions of magic. And within magic, there are like, it's like a tool kit of that do a lot of different things. So within the general toolkit of magic, you have things like divination, which is the use of symbolic systems like tarot or the I Ching or geomancy to be able to derive information from occult sources and, you know, to basically find deeper insights through the use of those tools. So divination is one part of it. You have astral travel, the ability to visit other kinds of dimensions at will and to utilize the astral body or the body of light to be able to traverse to these other places and to be able to even either affect things there or to be able to receive information from the sort of entities that might inhabit these different dimensions. You have banishing, the sort of like clearing and protective aspects of magic, you know, invoking to allow for a god or an angel or a higher dimensional being to inhabit your body and to be able to see things from their perspective and to commune with a higher source. There's evocation, the calling forth of spirits, which you would be able to command and direct. So, I mean, those are just like a few, but the point is magic's not like one thing. There are a lot of different sorts of disciplines, just like, you know, I don't want to use this example, but like in Harry Potter, you know, like in Hogwarts, there's like, you know, there's botany, there's divination, there's like all these different things. It's actually like that, though. Yeah. You know, and people have different kinds of actual inclinations towards different disciplines within magic and different kinds of talents or natural abilities towards different things. You know, some people are really rational minded and really intellectual, and they might really do really good, like with like Kabbalah and Gematria and that kind of stuff. Which is the kind of deriving of secret meanings of words through their numerological equivalences. And those correspond to different places in the Kabbalistic tree of life. And it's very like mathy and complicated. And then some people might be really good at divination, like just really good at working with symbols and having a really well developed intuition. And, you know, so it's a lot of different things. And then within like schools or traditions of magic, there are, you know, many different kinds. There is within ceremonial magic, there's the Hermetic tradition of magic, which kind of stretches back to Alexandrian Egypt, but surfaced in, you know, the kind of Victorian lodges in Britain. So you get like the Order of the Golden Dawn, and then Aleister Crowley had an offshoot of that, which was his own system and sort of religion called Thelema, which is philosophically distinct from other forms of ceremonial magic and has a bit more kind of a philosophical implication to it. And then there's chaos magic, which is kind of like a DIY kind of postmodern anarchist version of magic, like fuck around and find out. But is also really, really like incredible and useful and effective. And yeah, I guess that there is definitely a distinction between practical magic, like results magic, which is what chaos magic is generally, and theurgy, which is, you know, the magic for the use of initiation, realization, the completion of the great work, ascension, etc., like however you want to call it. And so ceremonial magic, although there is practical magic there, it's one of the things that you learn if you're doing ceremonial magic, is generally, and I know this isn't fully accurate, but it's useful shorthand to say that it is a type of theurgy, that it is interested in the alchemical process of the ascension of the soul. And it's a way of undertaking that through a kind of a system that is laid out on a specific kind of spiritual map, etc.
Incredible. Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing how much resolution and fine detail you lose just by the high level umbrella terms, right? It's easy to dismiss an entire, yeah, deep wisdom tradition as just this one-off thing or the one concept that you have in your head. And there's something I've really come to appreciate, and I think it's also why several of these lineages or traditions exist for as long as they do, because they seem to be able to tackle both breadth. Like there's enough variety of the experience that you can find what really clicks for you. And then when you found that, it also has depth. So you can actually keep going into it and it grows with you as your own skills and capacity increases. There doesn't seem to come a time when you've actually like outgrown the system, the process, the technique. You can actually just keep leveling up or going deeper into it. And man, I mean, at least on a personal level, like, yeah, pay attention when you find things like that, because it's really nice. It's really nice to be able to go into a single discipline. And I've been really interested in the mastery process as a metaphor lately, of just something that you can actually dedicate a life of study to. And in some ways, perhaps even barely scratch the surface, but that path and that process will take you very far.
Yeah, that is definitely one of the things that appeals to me about magic, is that there's within it the quest for mastery. And it is a zero-sum game. It is an infinite game. It's It's an infinite game. And so it's one of those things where, yeah, you can literally do it for the rest of your life. And there's no end to its depth or its breadth. And that's what's so fascinating about it. I mean, I think that like practical magic can get kind of old in a certain way. It's like it loses its novelty at a certain point. It's just like less fun or less enjoyable. But the actual kind of like initiatory journey of magic, it never ends.
Yeah, beautifully said. I just had a question come up that I really want your take on, because I dropped a video about this like last week. One of the things you've spoken to essentially being able to realize your desires. And actually, there are many people who are probably a little disempowered around that. And one of the ways this comes up for me is, I mean, there's a part of me that can't fault people who resist their own desire, because often I think the two, I mean, at least in Western culture, the two dominant kind of metaphysical narratives we're told view desire as essentially awful. And the kind of, these are somewhat low resolution, but I think they stand. Like, I think Christianity and religion vilifies a lot of base human desire as the kind of vehicle of sin. It'll take you to places you do not want to go. The same thing with scientific materialism in a way. You know, you're kind of dumb, stupid monkey at your base desire level, and the things that come up naturally in you are animalistic and impure. And so we're actually taught to like resist a lot of the natural desire and impulse that come up with us. I think there is a process where if you start leaning into that, there's often the kind of hedonistic explosion when you're first just like, I'm just going to do everything. I'm going to make myself feel good all the time. But one of the things I don't feel like comes into the conversation a lot is, yeah, you can, there's something beyond that though. There's a much like deeper, I would almost use the term like more pure desire that can come up that is often beyond the kind of simple gratifications of sense objects. Do you have a take on, yeah, if you could speak to just desire and anything that came up there for you?
Yeah, I mean, my perspective is that it's useful for people to work with their desires, because even if what they desire is not for the ultimate expression of who they are as a being, it's going to, through the exploration of the desire, lead them one step closer towards the full expression of who they are as a being. And that people kind of need to start with where they are, but that if you don't exhaust desire, it doesn't go away, you know? And I think that's kind of like, I'm not that really well versed in Tantra, but I think that's a kind of like tantric perspective in a certain way. The idea that, you know, you can't just make yourself stop wanting something. So you just need to like do it until you don't want to do it anymore, and exhaust the desire. And within the Temple of Psychic Youth, which was one of the magical orders that existed in the 1980s and 90s, they had this ritual process where they would do a sigil ritual once a month. And you would do it once a month for 23 months in a row. And it is intended to help you go towards your true self and to realize your true desires. But the desires that you sigilize can be anything. And the idea is, if you just start sigilizing your desires and they happen, like you might have this fantasy about, you know, being with some woman or something like that, and it actually happens, and then you realize that that's not actually what you want, and that process is good, you know, even if it's uncomfortable, even if it's painful, it's good because it's leading you closer towards actually understanding what it is that you really, really want. And within Thelema, the word Thelema itself means divine will, or will capital W, what Aleister Crowley called the true will. And the idea is that we have a sort of divine sovereign purpose. There's a reason why we exist, that we play a function, we play a role within the unfolding of the universe, but that people are sheltered from that, or that becomes obscured through contrary influences, external influences, you know, what your parents told you to do, your family of origin, your cultural upbringings, your schooling, social imprinting, etc. That these take us away from ourselves, and our true nature and our true desires are deeply sacred, and they're deeply and wholly sacred in the sense that it is as sacred as a river, or as a volcano, or any other natural process. And that's something sort of distinct and separate from sort of egoic desire, which is, oh, I want this because I saw this, you know, commercial on TV for this thing or whatever it is. But the exploration of those, what you might call base desires or egoic desires, might actually help somebody go towards those things. And so I think our desires are sacred. I'm not really, you know, obviously you can't just do what you want all the time. I don't advocate for that. And that's not how I live at all. I'm actually fairly disciplined about my hedonism nowadays. But I think that our desires are sacred. I think that it's something to listen to as if it's like the voice of God, you know, that's as sacred as any other kind of human experience.
Beautifully said. Yeah. And this has been something I've almost been trying to trust and develop in myself the past few years, particularly as my high level narratives have shifted, where it's like, I really like the playground example you used earlier, right? Reality is a kind of playground. Or again, the infinite game is another really good example. And that kind of begs the question of like, well, how am I supposed to figure out what is mine to do and where I'm supposed to go and what comes next for me? Like, I wish there was a breadcrumb trail. I wish there was a map I could take. And the thing is, like, it's very easy to spend your whole life like looking out in the world, never realizing, or at least the frame that I've been using a lot is, you actually have an internal compass that points you exactly like where to go next. And you can start fine tuning that and you can start listening to it. And it comes up in the form of desires, interests, impulses, natural curiosity, things that light you up and excite you and give you energy rather than take them away. And yeah, there is almost a kind of mastery process there too, of like really being able to listen deeply to what the true intention of that is. But if you do, yeah, I like how you said, if you just make a habit of it, and like almost commit to following your pure desire and intent, can take you some incredibly, incredibly beautiful places.
Absolutely. It comes down a lot to self-trust. And I think a lot of people don't really trust themselves. And when you feel those impulses or those sort of leanings towards being in a particular place, doing a particular thing, talking to a particular person, whatever it is, and you actually listen to that, you have, in my experience, very synchronistic, remarkable things that can happen that are quite astonishing, that seem to indicate that you are following some kind of breadcrumb trail of destiny or fate that is laid out by who knows what, you know, from who knows where. But it seems like that's what happens. And I've had a lot of those experiences. And I'm grateful for them. And sometimes I get, the impulse to, like, I don't know, like, you know, drink coffee in some restaurant I never go to for some reason, that I run into some person there that, you know, like, just weird things happen like that. And that person opens some door that changed my life in some way. And these kinds of things, they happen. If you start to follow the whispers, as I like to say. And I do think that your intuition and these sort of higher cognitive abilities are something that you can train and work with. And the process of ritual magic is one of those things, as well as working with tools like tarot cards or dream work, or there's so many different kinds of exercises and practices, but like the higher your vibe, quote unquote, the more you're kind of going to probably have these types of experiences and at least have more information at your disposal to be able to follow. And, you know, a lot of people are not in the right place in their life or are not fully in the groove of their existence, because they don't listen to their feelings, because they don't listen to either the go towards or the go away from feelings that I think are really, really important to listen to.
Yeah, I think just the single commitment of I'm actually going to trust myself and that the things that arise in me are good and benevolent and for my benefit and the world's benefit, that single switch, I think, the way I've been saying it the past few months is your life following that can actually become far better than the dreams you have for it. Because even your dreams were like this casualty of growing up in a society and culture that told you to like play it small, play it safe, you know, go this way, go that way. And so even your dreams are stuck in that cage still. But if you follow, yeah, you can call it whatever you want, some divine intelligence, some deep ancestral wisdom that's just sewn into your DNA, your life will be better than your dreams, because man, it's going to take you on a process. And all we almost full circle in that, where some of it might be an initiation process. Some of it might be really fucking challenging. It might confront you with a lot, but the other side of those experiences and those paths is mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah, there's sort of this thing, I think, where it's kind of like this idea that, you know, spirit wants what's best for you, but what's best for you isn't always what's fun for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautifully said. I want to bring up some of the tech stuff. I know you've played in some VR crypto spaces, but before that, I was tracking that you also have you're actually about to drop like a magic course, essentially almost like an introductory magic course. One, can you speak to what that is? And two, the question of just what on earth do you put in like an introduction to magic course?
So it's a 12-week course. It's called Magic 101. You can go to magic101course.com to find information about it. But I invited different practitioners who are all basically esteemed experts at different aspects of magic. Like we said, it's a lot of different things. So this is like a broad survey of the different disciplines involved in magic, with different people who have specialties, who have written books about or have lectured about or taught about different aspects of magic for a long time, and kind of represent different sorts of camps of different types of magic. So it's really amazing. I mean, a lot of the people that are teaching are people that I've looked up to a lot within my journey and are kind of like heroes of mine. So to be able to be facilitating that is really amazing. And it's going to be an incredible journey. I think that I think that it will be an initiation for people in some way. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to be looking at what we really want out of life and how do we get it. And we're going to try to run, you know, full speed towards that using really powerful techniques. And it's going to stir some things up. You know, I don't think anybody's life is going to be the same on the other side of it. And that's a good thing as far as I'm concerned. And my life is certainly already not the same just by initiating the process of creating this course. And I don't even know what it's going to be like to be in it. It starts next week and it's going to be really something special. I've been in the magic community at least for a few years now, and I've taken a lot of online courses about magic, and I've not seen anything like this before, where you have such a collection of experts and these really, really experienced magical practitioners all coming together to share different insights, different experiences, and different perspectives all together within a 12-week online course. So, you know, it's a little bit experimental, but I think it'll be fantastic.
Damn, that's amazing. And I've felt that a bit too with some of the offerings we've released with High Existence, where, you know, you can find yourselves in a lot of spaces, a lot of experiences, a lot of offerings, but there's always something that comes up where it's like, I know I want this to exist, but I can't find it in the world. It looks like I'm going to have to be the one to make it. And that I mean, that's a really fun process. Like, what is the exact thing I wish I had right now, or that the me 5 years ago could have benefited from a lot? That is a great game to play. Yeah, so as I started following you more, one of the things I saw you coming out about, in actually a really playful way, which I deeply appreciated because I think this conversation deserves some levity around it. But you also speak quite well, and I think quite correctly, to some of the shadow side of spirituality, some spiritual bypassing, maybe some cliches that we can often find in the spiritual communities or the spiritual world. I mean, how does that stuff land for you? How do you relate to bypassing or spiritual narcissism or anything like that, or the spiritual ego?
Well, I live in Ubud, Bali, which is, you know, one of those places where there's definitely a lot of that, which fortunately I don't really interact with too much anymore, but it's a, I don't, you know, like for me, it's like, I guess, you know, I created those videos because it's like, I'm just being a dick. You know, it's like, it's fun for me. And because I just see so much of it here, and it's really absurd to me, you know, like I think it's funny on one hand, and it also kind of like annoys me on another hand. I don't want to like judge people, but it's like within my own discernment process, like the type of people I wouldn't want to really be friends with just based off of this kind of like this attitude. And really for me, spirituality, I guess, or these sorts of esoteric systems are supposed to help bring people closer to truth, whatever that means, but like closer towards an approximation of something real, you know, something that can like actually help people and actually change people's experience of life. And I guess that what I find challenging is when it's the same kinds of traps and pitfalls that you would find anywhere else within Western materialist postmodern culture. It's just packaged in this kind of spiritual way. And unfortunately, people are very vulnerable to that stuff. And there's a lot of predatory behavior with, you know, men being predatory towards women sexually, using the kind of spiritual stuff to like game that, or people in general using it a lot for kind of just selfish purposes, for like, you know, for commercial reasons or whatever it is. And I have nothing against people wanting to have sex, and I have nothing against people wanting to sell stuff. Like, money's good, sex is good. I have something against people being shady about that, or like dishonest about it, and hiding their intentions, veiling their intentions, being sneaky, lying about it. And yeah, there's a lot of lying, I guess, that I notice within spiritual communities. And whether people are even conscious that they're doing it or not, they might be lying to themselves. Yeah. And I just see a lot of like, there's a lot of shame. You know what I mean? Like, I've been to sort of like tantric play parties, right? Where people are like, it's like we want to have sex, but like, we're not going to say that we want to have sex. Like, we want to just, this is spiritual, you know? And it's like, this is a spiritual thing. You know what I mean? And so it creates this like weird vibe where like you get these people that like are in these environments, and they get like ravenous and like predatory, and women feel freaked out and like, you know, like preyed upon. And then I've been to like sex dungeons in Berlin where like the people are like, yeah, we just want to fuck. And like, it's so honest. And there's, because of the honesty, because it's brought out into the light, it's so clear, and boundaries are so respectfully upheld
and everybody knows what they're getting into, and there's no like delusion about it. And it makes the environment like much safer and much like lighter and like less creepy, interestingly. And so, yeah, I see this sort of dynamic a lot within spiritual communities, you know. And I guess maybe when I was younger, I was more, it was easier for me to fall victim to it. Yep. And it was only through having sort of negative experiences that allowed me to create the discernment around it. And when I see people behaving in that way, I don't feel like it's necessary to call people out necessarily, but it kind of makes me cautious of them, and to even want to maybe bring awareness to people to be a little bit more cautious, because I just have really seen, I've met very, very few enlightened people in general, but especially within spiritual communities. I've maybe even met more enlightened people outside of spiritual communities.
Mm. Yeah, powerfully said. Man, I think one of the things I just appreciated most about those is it still feels like it's almost like a taboo to even talk about shadow spirituality, bypassing narcissism, spiritual ego. It's just not even on the table for healthy discussion. And I mean, I think you pointed to it right there with the example, like anything left in the dark just festers and becomes really perverse, and it's not helpful. It's not actually beneficial. So yeah, huge shout out and respect for actually being even willing to start voicing it. It feels like we're still just starting the process of even getting it into the conversation rather than even being able to do anything about it yet.
You know, it's okay to like taking drugs. It's okay to like having sex. It's okay to like making money. I like all those things. And, you know, you don't have to be like, you know, if you wanted like sacred sex or like tantra or whatever is beautiful, but like, you don't have to do that to justify wanting to have sex. And there is a lot of that within spiritual communities, or like participating in some kind of like a plant medicine ceremony with a sacred intention is beautiful also, but you shouldn't have to always do something spiritual to like justify a desire to get high. Like, it's okay to just get high sometimes. You know what I mean?
Oh man, that's a really significant point. I hope people people should rewind and listen to that again. Yeah, this need to justify your own existence, rationalize everything away, or prove that it's, yeah, it's almost a self-trust thing again. Like, you are not broken. You do not need to prove yourself. You do not need to justify your actions. And yeah, because it creates a lot of these mental gymnastics to the point, I think you also spoke to that, like to the point where people might even delude themselves. They don't know that this is happening. And that is actually, I like the word that you used of being cautious of people like that, because that's actually really scary when you're like a, lack of deep self-awareness can be a challenge, can be really toxic, can be really dangerous.
Yeah. And the root is shame. Mm. And, you know, the root of narcissism is shame. You know, narcissism is a word that gets thrown around a lot. Like, how many people are, there's a spectrum. How many people are actually narcissists? Like, maybe a small percentage. But yeah, within a psychological landscape, I think shame is at the root of a lot of narcissistic behavior.
Yeah. Yeah. Completely agree. There's one last topic I want to hear your quick take on, because at first I was a little surprised, but as I settled into it more, seeing it in you, it became quite natural for me. But you've also done some, you've both done some work, and I think you have an interest, or at least have explored the emerging kind of tech world, right? VR, crypto, NFTs, the Web3 space in general. I actually had a really wonderful moment, goodness, a few weeks ago, a few months ago, where I had, I was watching and actually wrote about the crypto psychedelic conference that happened I think back in 2017. And it was only a few weeks ago that I realized that you were the one who designed the logo for that.
It's true. I did.
Yeah. It's amazing. So yeah, like how do you see an intersection between some of the visionary art space? Like where did your interest in or exploration in some of that come from?
Well, I've been a digital artist for a lot of my life, and digital art has always been one of my main mediums. I don't like everything that's going on in the NFT world, that's for sure, but I think that NFTs are an amazing thing for digital artists. You know, it's been this year, it's been incredibly impactful and beneficial for me as a digital artist to be able to sell my digital artwork, and has been, you know, a great source of abundance to fuel my creativity. And, you know, I'm very much crypto positive, I guess you could say. and I think it's just, you know, a decentralized world is a better place than the kind of world that we are in now. And there's the potential for harm with any of these technologies, but there's a lot of potential for good as well. And it will be used for both. And that's just kind of what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. A recurring pattern in some of the topics we've covered here. These are powerful technologies, right? They can go either way. It depends on how you want to use them and what they're used for.
They're just tools.
Yeah.
You know, and don't be afraid of the tools. Be afraid of the people using them, you know, and learn to use the tools. And, you know, I guess there's like this theme within this conversation, which is really about like coming down to self-knowledge in a certain way, because people are less afraid of tools if they really trust themselves.
Mm. Yep.
You know, like I know I'm not going to get addicted to virtual reality. I have virtual reality and I use it, but I've never, ever even been close to being addicted to it because I know myself. And I know that I'm able to moderate my behavior and I can control my impulses and things like that. And I think that people are afraid of virtual reality and think that it's going to take over the world and everybody's going to get addicted to it or whatever, because they don't fully trust themselves. But like, I can moderate my behavior of my use of social media or of the smartphone or whatever, you know, food, whatever it is. You know what I mean? And so it comes down to like your relationship with yourself. And if you really are like, I think that I could maintain my sovereignty in the face of all these emerging technologies. You know, there's definitely a lot of nefarious stuff going on within some of it, you know, like, I have my concerns about like the metaverse and stuff like that, but like it is what it is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And what a potent place to wrap in, honestly. Trust yourself. Self-trust and self-knowledge are extremely foundational. And I think we have, pointed to that with language in several different ways, this conversation. Man, I guess maybe a last question of just, so we spoke about the magic course coming out next week. Anything else on the radar for you? What's next? What are you working on? Where can people find you? Anything you want to say?
There's a few things. I'm working on a really huge project, which is to paint the 22 major arcana of the tarot. And I've done 6 paintings so far and I'm working on the 7th. So that's like big emerging project that I'm excited about. I'm trying to get my Patreon community rolling. So now I'm doing like exclusive workshops and classes in my Patreon, which you can find through my Instagram. And so I'm trying to get that rolling and I want to put more energy into that. And right now I feel more inspired to teach and to do podcasting and online workshops and that kind of stuff than anything else. And so I'm putting a lot of energy into that. And I have the magic course, but I want to put a lot of that energy into the Patreon community as well. And I've basically cut off my use of social media. I I'm not really personally interacting with social media anymore, whereas it used to be very accessible through it. And I'm basically migrating to Patreon. So like, I used to be really accessible. I used to answer a lot of questions to people through social media. I'm not doing that anymore, but I'm doing now weekly live question and answer sessions over Zoom through my Patreon. So if you subscribe for only $5, we can talk about anything you want for basically as, you know, within reason, as long as you want, and discuss magic, arts, business, life, whatever you'd feel like. And yeah, so that's something I'm excited about. It hasn't come yet, but I like ordered new microphone and like a bunch of upgrades for kind of like my tech for online broadcasting, and I feel the signal is being boosted, and that feels fun.
Oh, amazing. And yeah, another shout out of just, we will have literally links for all of this stuff in the show notes. I mean, I feel like we barely scratched the surface here of you, right? You have an entire podcast running, a whole lot of courses, videos, workshops, offerings. So man, I would highly encourage anyone who got this far to dig a lot deeper into your work and who you are and what you're doing. I think the only thing left to say is, man, thank you. This was really beautiful, and I'm really glad we were able to create this for people and send it out into the world.
Yeah, this was a really fun podcast, and it was so powerful that it killed it. It sucked all the power out of my house.
We'll go with that. We'll go with that frame. I love it.
Yeah, it was a like genuinely really stimulating conversation. I really appreciate this time with you. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Of course, man. Thank you. Hey, everybody. As always, thank you so much for tuning in here. If you'd like to explore more of Jake and his teachings and experiences, you can find all the links and resources in the show notes below. If this was useful, if this was insightful, if this was fun, consider sending it to someone who might enjoy it. With that said, we'll see you very soon for another episode. And until then, I love you, stay well, and we'll talk again soon. Peace.